طفلة تمتطيه قوس قزح، طفلة.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, where each week you will hear the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian perspective, the Palestinian voice exploring the realities of the Israeli occupation of the Palestinian homeland. You will not hear this narrative very often in the Western media, which is why it is important that we present it each week on This Week in Palestine. This is your host, John Roberts. Today, increasingly, rappers and hip-hop artists are viewed as modern-day truth-tellers, lauded and sometimes taunted for telling it like it is. Their dissection of our various cultures is often prophetic. After years of struggle, rap and hip-hop artists have assumed their well-earned place in our artistic culture. Today we feature a conversation with Palestinian rap artist Tamar Nafar, one of the founders of the celebrated Palestinian rap group Dam, whose truth-telling has created great controversy within Israeli society. Nafar and Dam are from the Arabic community in Lydd, Israel. It is in the belly of the beast, so to speak, that they speak truth to power through their rap. Here is Tamar Nafar speaking on the Palestinian podcast with its host, Salem Barakhme.
لما البوليس سألك تعرف مين بيجيب لسمومة قلت له طبعا بعرف مين بيجيب الحكومة مش بيجوا من برا البلاد انتو حرس الحدود احنا لعنا سفن لا جيبات ولا رخص طيارات قلت لأمك انك نمت عند اصحاب هلت لك سمعت بالسجن قلت لها يما هناك كل اصحاب واحنا احنا مش الاصحاب احنا العيل شرينا عنين لانك راجع مع قصة الليل بصحت بصحت يا ناس حد يساعده يرفع ايده بحاول يضرب معي كاس دير السيارة ديرها مش هستناهم بكرة انا وياه بنضحك في نص مستشفياتهم انت امسكوا من اجري بمسك راسه انا حبيبي بلا سلام يا صاحبي رمى راسه لورا
Hi everyone, Salem Barakhme here, the director of PIPD, with another episode of Berdashe, a series where we talk to inspiring and amazing Palestinians about their lives and careers. Today we're joined with hip-hop and Palestinian hip-hop and rap star Tamar Nafar. Tamar, thank you for being with us. How are you holding up?
Thank you for having me, man.
Of course. How are you holding up these days?
Well, I'm cool. I'm enjoying every moment, but I miss my crowd, man. I just miss the shows. That's all I need, shows.
I can imagine as an artist and performer, it's a big part of your life not to have.
I actually enjoyed the break at the beginning. Mm-hmm. And then when I did like a few live shows from my house, like everyone was doing. And I've said, I kind of enjoy it that I don't have to leave the house. I finished the show and I'm at my bed. But then they gave us this license to do a performance, a professional one on a big stage with my whole band, but without the crowd. Yeah. So there I felt it. I felt like, wow.
Yeah, wow. A show without the people can be, you know, on a stage could be somewhat surreal.
And I we were so charismatic and energetic that, you know, we did a reverse. It hit us on the reverse. Like, we were so sad that we did beyond what we were supposed to do. Like, there was a crown. But, you know, that's we just felt sad, you know.
I can imagine. But Tamar, we wanted to talk about your amazing career and life. And I wanted to start with, you know, your upbringing in Lydd. And what that was like for you and how it shaped you. Because I think a lot of people around the world don't really know what it's like to be a Palestinian from 48. And so we wanted to give them a bit of a glimpse into that.
it's confusing, but it's so clear at the same time. I mean, I'm going to speak about myself personally, because I am sure that, you know, for me, I grew up in a 50% Jews, 50% Arabs. But during the time, because when Arabs come, Jews leave. So with the time, it became like 95% Arabs. And you know, the houses drops with the prices, mm-hmm. and it automatically starts being shaped as a poor neighborhood. So growing up, I did have that contact with my Jewish neighbors, more or less. So I'm a kid, that was okay. Mm-hmm. Of course, you hear stuff like "dirty Arab." But, you know, it's not – back then for us, racism was – to notice racism, you had to – it had to take an act of verbs, like mm-hmm. you had to say. And, you know, when you grow up more, you start noticing your neighborhood, how the garbage – you know, sometimes we had to burn because they don't always pick up the garbage can, they don't know, so you have to burn it. Even though we pay the municipality to do that. Mm-hmm. So things like that, you notice, but you think it's okay because you and your other Arab friends are the same. So for you, it's okay. But when you get out and you see the other neighborhoods, it's like, what the fuck? Okay, there's a difference. So yeah. This is where we start to notice racism in a way. But it was, they treat us Arab citizens differently. This is what I used to say until I was like 18, 19, 20. There's a racism against us, the Israeli Arabs. When the second Intifada hit, and I've seen how they treated, you know, 13 Shaheeds. And the 13, how do you call them in English?
Martyrs.
Yeah. So this is where you start shaping your identity. Okay, so I'm a Palestinian. Okay, so I'm the same as the guy from Gaza. Not on my daily life, of course. I'm not trying to compare. Sure. Over here, yeah, I mean, it's way different, and everything is different in Gaza. Mm. So okay, so you start shaping it, and then you start meeting your heroes. Then you start reading about this guy. Then you watch this documentary. And then suddenly, whatever you felt during your life, you found the words for it. Mm. So this is what I felt. So this, it's just like, you know, it's like somebody who's feeling pain, and you just go to the doctor, and he found different names for that pain. That's the diagnosis, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it can. I think I experienced somewhat something similar. It's where you take your raw emotion and raw experiences, and that meets an intellectual understanding of the system around you and what goes on, yeah. Right? Yeah. What was that like facing that as a kid? You know, I'm sure, you know, being made to feel like another, living like a second class citizen. Also, Lid is, you know, has a lot of things that it's going through, right? On a social level, on a political level, on a community level.
That's as I said, it shapes you. And for me, as Tamer, again, it's very important to say, yes, we are a collective in a way. You know, we all get punched from the same fist, but the reaction sometimes is, the fall is sometimes individual. It's mm-hmm. different. So my reaction at the beginning is wanting to fit in even more.
Of course.
Like, it's like, okay, I noticed that, you know, I remember when my cousin got shot because Lid was very problematic, still problematic when it comes to crime. We were the biggest drug market in the Middle East, in the whole Middle East, my neighborhood. So.
Wow.
And now we are not New York. It's not millions of people. We are talking about almost 70,000 people. I would say maybe 25,000 Arabs, Palestinians. And I'm talking about like back then in the year 2000, 31, 35 youth got killed, shot. Arab on Arab crime. Okay. It's us versus the cops. Sometimes it's not soldiers. We don't have soldiers. Mm-hmm. This is how fucked up it is. The soldiers that we see in the TV, shooting at Gaza, we see them, just walking and going to their house like this, literally this house. So this is how weird it was.
It could be a mind fuck now to see that you have...
You know what? I remember something weird. I remember we had this nice neighbor he used to be our neighbor. You know what? I remember this now. Wow. This Jewish neighbor that we him and my dad used to play Sheshbesh, game board. And he wasn't in the army, or he was a bit older than the age that we met him when he, I don't know if he was in the army before, but of course now I know that he was. So he was like Hanania. That's what we call Hanania. So he was our neighbor. That's what we used to. And I was very friends with his kids. And I remember in the first Intifada, I was a kid. When was it? 87?
Around 87. Yeah.
Around 87. I was born at 79. I was like, what, 9?
About eight,
something like that. And I remember that he vanished. Like, we stopped seeing him. And I remember him coming back, remember seeing him. I saw him from, we are watching TV. We are seeing what's happening in the Intifada.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I remember all that I knew as a kid is like they are shooting Arabs. The soldiers are shooting Arabs. It's not my neighbors, I remember him. I was standing on the balcony and I saw him walking with the uniform.
Mm.
Because they recruit when there's a crisis. They recruit even the older one. And I called my dad and was like, "Look what is he wearing?" And my dad, he knew the reality. So he's like, "I know he's a soldier there. He's a neighbor here." So he wanted to throw, to throw something at him, to joke. And I remember I started freaking out, starting yelling and crying, because I thought that that's the same. If he's going to throw something at the soldier is going to shoot you. I forgot that story. So this is how complicated it is.
Yeah.
I remember in my neighborhood, we used to be, they did the separation and somehow we did the separation, because if I want to go into the store, I'm not going to say "Atini halib." I'm going to say "Tenli khalaf." That's the language of surviving in a way.
Yeah.
But I remember that my last Jewish friend from my childhood was when he reached the age 18 and he went to the army, and then we stopped talking. Automatically, both of us, it was just too weird for me. I didn't know how to explain it, but it was too weird for me. And then my next Jewish friends were not, they were just ones that I picked from the political struggle, the activist.
Yeah, it's very powerful. And it cannot be easy when you live in a space, in a place that tries to strip you from any shred of your identity as a Palestinian, as an Arab, whether it's through the education system, whether it's through the language, whether it's through the culture. So with those experiences, just your neighbor, who went to fight in the Second Intifada and shoot Palestinians, how do you navigate that as a Palestinian and your identity? How do you hold on to who you are and what you aspire to?
At the beginning, it was very confusing. As I said, I have this friend that used to go to the army and come back every last of the month. We were close friends from before that. I'll give you, I'll give you a weird story. You know, I had, you know, I started rising up in the Israeli hip hop scene.
Mm.
And there were like fascist Zionist rappers over there. Okay. And I remember once we all, I said something about Palestine. Right. And the fascist rappers wanted to fight me. Okay. Because they said something, I said something against the army. I criticized the army on the stage in the middle of Tel Aviv. I criticized the army, and the Israeli rap, the fascist rappers wanted to fight me backstage.
Mm-hmm.
Now my Jewish childhood friends who joined the army, right? They were in the crowd and they joined me to beat the shit out of the fascist rappers. So it was more of a hood thing over there, you know?
Yeah.
It's hard to explain.
Sure.
But that somehow made me feel good. But during the days, the story of the armies, when, you know, they always tried to separate. They would like, yeah, when I stand and I saw this Palestinian guy, he's a Palestinian. He's every time they said, the Arabs, sorry, not Arabs, Palestinians, like to separate me from them. This is where I started feeling, okay, you know what? Fuck it. I'm not part, don't fuck this friendship. Don't tell my narrative the way you want. It's yeah. Don't separate me. And I remember once, like we met once, twice. I mean, at the beginning, I didn't want to meet, but when we had the fight with the fascist rappers and they stood by me as a hood thing, that was a bit, made us a bit, but we met once. And on the second time, they shared the story that it was so ugly that it developed an argument, a verbal argument that it developed to a bit of violence.
Mm.
And this is it. Yeah. I think this is where I got out of the closet. I was like, you know what? I'm fully Palestinian and I'm not confused anymore.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow.
I hope I make sense. I don't want.
No, man. It's listen, identity is an extremely complex construct and it is made up of so many different forces and experiences, right? And so it's only natural, I think, for someone who has experienced everything you've experienced to go through all these different evolutions.
I know, but sometimes the story is very known for me.
Yeah.
And it's pure and it's honest. And for people sometimes from the outside, they're like, so you used to hang with soldiers. They don't. So sometimes I forget about them and I take it for granted that people get. So I'm not trying to tell a romantic story where I was born and my dad named me Palestine after. No, it never happened. And, you know, my first word was freedom. I'm not there. I'm being honest and I'm showing the complicity. So.
And I think I really appreciate it, Tamer. And I think everyone watching will as well. So what, I guess, what inspired you to turn to rap and hip hop? And what part of that was part of your political awakening, as you say, come out of the closet politically in terms of your...
Tupac. I have this line. Even at the class, I never knew math. When the teacher asked 1 + 1, I was like, Tupac? I think it was Hala, if you hear me. I mean, I liked hip hop. I liked rapping. It made me do like this when I've heard the Heavy D verse on Jam, Michael Jackson. I think it was Heavy D there, right? Jam, here come the man, hot damn, the big boys. Yeah, I think that was it. It made me look like this. And the Fresh Prince, of course, we all yes. even if I didn't know it was rap, you know, you just like Will Smith and whatever he's so it was Will but what made me really like, you know, and Criss Cross came and a bit of Bone Thugs and Harmony, you know, they had this amazing melodic singer, I think Cross You at the Crossroad. So anyway, it was all around, And then I had it as a character when LL Cool J dropped Mama Said Knock You Out. And yeah. I was like, I wanted to buy a jacket like him. That I remember looking for a jacket like LL Cool J because that dude looked tough in the video. Yeah. I'm going to knock you. But what made me sit, okay, stop it. You know what? It was an Ethiopian neighbor, an Ethiopian Jewish neighbor. He brought me a pot. I was listening to this and I was like, man, this is bullshit. You need to listen to Tupac. You need to listen to this guy called Tupac. Yeah. He talks about us. He talks about him as an Ethiopian Jewish. Not, he needs to talk about us. He needs to talk about us. You need to check him out. So he got me, I think, what got me was the song called Hala If You Hear Me. And the visual got me. It was just like my neighborhood. Yeah. So visually he got me and he made me get a dictionary and just search for the lyrics. You know, internet was new back then. There was only one internet in the whole city, in the library. Yeah. So I used to go there and I used to print lyrics. There was this website called Ola, I think, .com, OHHLA.com. It used to have lyrics. And I used to type Tupac's lyrics and I just sit. It's the first time in my life that I entered the library. I was very not the best student. But that what made me. Just
yeah.
Pac also helped me. You know, I had to go west to understand the east. You know, I had to go back away from home to understand my home. And then when I got to this song, A White Man's World, where I thought it's political, but it was more social because he's saying it's a white man's world on top. Means that on the bottom it's a black woman, so it's a dedicated song to the sisters. And at the beginning there's a sample, you're gonna bump your fist against the wall, boy. That's what the white man wants to do. And I searched for it, and it was sampled from the movie Malcolm by Spike Lee and Denzel Washington. So I watched the movie, I fell in love with Malcolm, bought the autobiography, and it just came.
Yeah, it's very interesting that you bring up these references right now with everything going on in the world, you know, in the U.S. and other you know, in other cities, the protests for the black struggle. You know, it seems that a lot of the culture around the black struggle in the 90s helped shape who you are. As you say, you had to look west to understand you. What do you think about everything that's going on in the moment, and how does that relate to some of the things that we experience?
It's just heartbreaking, man. Just before everything, before analyzing the politics, before everything, seeing that video of George Floyd is just makes you cry. The guy was thinking of his kids, I think. It's just sad. And it's, you know, one of those things that it can be stopped. It just can be stopped easily. People were telling him in the streets, you're choking. I don't know, man. It's just, but it feels different this time. As well, I really hope that the world will shout the same when they see what happens to Iyad al-Hallaq or Yunus, the guy that was shot in the at the entrance of the hospital.
You know, one thing that the black struggle and the Palestinian struggle have linked is that they are both challenging systems of supremacy and systems of oppression, right? And for throughout the histories of our struggle, they've been very much joined together. And there's been solidarity, whether it's black solidarity with the Palestinian struggle and vice versa. And I think more than ever that, you know, we demand and ask for people to stand with us, we should also be very vocal and you know, in standing and showing solidarity with others around the world. It's so important now, and because we in many ways do face the same systems of supremacy and oppression.
Yeah.
For sure. Yeah, man.
Allah, it's the video is very hard, and you know, just black lives matters, and I think
yeah, absolutely, black lives matter, man. I heard a lot of what you said in terms of you know, that culture, hip hop culture, rap culture, inspiring you and shaping you in the, you know, in the 90s, I think, right? So what led you to start rapping in hip hop? You know, how did you start? How did Damn come to be? And you also rap mostly, if predominantly, in Arabic, which is also a very, you know, it's a big statement given everything we talked about in terms of identity and where you are.
At the beginning, actually, when I started in English.
Okay.
That's what I heard. You know, that was built in. And then when I wanted to do it in Arabic, it just sounded ridiculous. Just something didn't work there. Because there's no reference. There is nothing. And then I heard of this Israeli hip-hop scene in Tel Aviv. Mm. So it's like, okay, it's not in English. They rap in Hebrew. I'm going there just to laugh, just to see how bad it is. And dude, they can flow.
Yeah.
I was stunned. Now, I'm not talking about the lyrics, you know, I have my love for hip hop. I didn't even notice the lyrics. I'm sure a lot of them were not good politically for me, but something with the flow, and it just worked. And with the wordplay, it's like, okay. If it makes sense in Hebrew, it will make sense in Arabic. So I started working on my Arabic. I started rapping in Hebrew as well. And twice I was the best lyricist in Hebrew when it comes to wordplays and funny metaphors. And so, and then I started to develop my Arabic thing. And then a friend of mine who was in France, when he came, he brought me this Algerian hip hop album. He found it in Virgin, I think, by MBS, Micro Brizzly Silence. And, you know, it wasn't Arabic. It was, you know, in between French, Arabic, and Berber. Mm. Mostly Berber. But the few Arab lines there, because, you know, there was similarity in the word. Like, damn, that sounds good. And somehow this album was like, okay, oh, you're looking for a place to sit here. Sit. And he took my flow and... It's like he used, like, in the flow, he used like 3-4 Arabic words, but they were tight on the snare that only these 4 words, they were the key. Like, you know, like instructions from IKEA. Like, this is where you put this. Because at the beginning, I used to write lyrics in Arabic, and I look at them, and it was so, it's not working. Like, it sounds good in my head. The lyric sounds dope. The beat sounds dope. But it doesn't work together. How? And when I heard them rapping in French, and they used like one word in Arabic, another word in Arabic, it's like, as I said, it's like an IKEA instructions. Oh, so this comes here. And bang, it came. I just understood how. I understood how to treat the syllables in Arabic. Mm-hmm. It's just how to use those. It was different. I mean, it's like before that, I used to write like a rhyme between, I don't know, I'm looking around, Tawlat, Talajat. That was, and it did Tawlat, Talajat. And then when I broke it down to syllables, I was like, no, tawlat doesn't work with talajat. It means tawlat, dawlat, awa, awla. You know, just work with the syllables. Irmi bijawba, tawda. Just work with the syllables. And then I wrote my first syllable rhymes. I went with badita nazeh min ijarab, lani samah kif almara, abi arab ala shabi so badafah an alarab. So I started. And it just made sense. And I recorded my first single. Mm. I used the beat of R. Kelly and Nas. Have you ever thought that you can be the rich? I just used that. And I tried it in the house. Just recorded it. Just a quick one. And back then it was the times of Napster and ICQ. And
yeah.
Just recorded it. I sent it to a friend. I don't know how he sent it to this one, how he sent it to, I don't know. I just sent it to my friend to ask his opinion. A month after, I'm walking in the street and a car walks by with a song. Okay. I don't know how. Okay, a car walks by in the song. Then a guy calls me 2 months after and he's like, listen, we have a radio show, in the main radio show in the north, and we've been looking for you. We don't know your name. And even though I say in the song, Nitel al Alif lal Mer, it's like Snoop saying in the song SNOOP, and someone's asking him, what is your name? It's like, I just said it. but it's not casual for us to say, you know, they're not used to say your song. You don't see Amri Diab going, oh, Amri Diab. And he's like, your song has been the number one hit in the north. I went there to make an interview. Then a guy calls me and he's like, we have a show. And I used to perform only in Tel Aviv for 70 people. Mm. And those 70 people were rappers. Like, if I going on stage, there are 70 people, I'm going down, one of them is going to come up and bet. It's like, everyone, that's how it is. There was not a scene yet. And suddenly, a guy from Nazareth calls me and is like, we want you to come and perform. I went there. And do 2,000 people.
Wow.
Okay, what? Okay, maybe they're just happy for, it's like, okay. And then somebody performed and people were talking and it's like, okay, so it's just, you know, they're gathering around. And as soon as they presented me on stage, people started running and singing the song. They're just like, what the fuck is going on? What is it? What's happening? 2 days after, a guy's called me. He's like, I want to manage you. Okay. And then I never stopped performing until Corona came. You know, that's the longest that I haven't performed since 2000.
Wow. And can I ask you, did you start off by making political music, or was that an evolution to your music?
You what?
Make a music that was political.
No, that was an evolution. Definitely an evolution. You know, as this single succeeded, Mahmoud and Suhail joined me and we formed them. At the beginning, Suhail is my little brother. He used to be the hype man on stage.
Okay.
We used to be political against the police.
Got it.
I'll try to explain it. I think we used to be political as Arab citizens of this community. Like, we are citizens here and we are trying, you know, like we are the same as Ethiopians. The same as Iraqi Jews, you know, it's a bad situation, and we want to fix it.
Mm.
That was it, but Intifada made it more clear. Mm. Like, before that, it was fuck the police. You know what? At the beginning, it was NWA, fuck the police. After that, we went hardcore Public Enemy, Dead Prez. Like, nice. I'm an African. Never been an African American. That's the best example. We went from NWA to Dead Prez. That's it. Before the Intifada, and what happened after the Intifada?
So the second Intifada was the catalyst for you in terms of your political evolution in many ways.
Like, at the beginning, when I used to stand on the Tel Aviv stages and I used to say stuff like, they don't let me inside of the club because I'm a Palestinian, because I'm an Arab. And they were like, yeah, it's good for you to talk about these things. I have this metaphor. I said it once in an interview. Like the relationship is good if I'm the gardener of their house. You know, if I'm working in the garden, because they always use, I don't hate Arabs. I fix my car at an Arab place. I don't hate Arabs. I eat hummus. Like they don't get that. Giving you a specific job in their life, a specific service in their life, that already, even if you take that service or not, or even if you ask for that, but to see me as a certain service in your life, this is what makes it racist.
Mm.
So I used to say like this, this is my hip hop. This is my hip hop career. Like, when I used to work in the garden, as a metaphor, like their gardener, I was like, okay, you see, the two Arabs and Jews, they get along. But when I used to stand up, I was like, hey, I think that the garden belonged to my grandfather. I think it was my land. I was like, this is where the part, where the problem starts.
Mm.
And I remember that when the Intifada happened, I had this song that I was so pissed off that I also got, I downloaded the Tupac and the Outlaws beat, Hail Mary.
Yeah.
Come with me. Hail Mary. Yeah, I think this one. And I wrote a song about the Intifada of 2000. Not about the whole Intifada, but specifically about the 13 Palestinians inside of Israel. I felt more, you know, I was still there. I'm explaining the evolution of it. And I think I stood on stage in the middle of Tel Aviv on a night that was celebrating the Zionist hip hop. And they had all kind of, that's funny, they had, you know, like all kind of songs about the army. And one of the guys, look how, one of the guys went on stage to do a song about the army and he was wearing a Muhammad Ali shirt. I didn't have to be political to understand, like,
hypocrisy. That.
Yeah, because Muhammad Ali was against the, if you want to go, anyway, so.
Yeah.
And I went there so naive that, of course, they're going to accept it. Of course, they're going to accept it. And I went there, and that's what I said before, in Hebrew, before you get me, before you judge me, before you sympathize with me, before you punish me, walk in my shoes and you will hurt your feet. Because yes, we are criminals, because we throw stones and stuff, but we are innocent criminals, because this is what you force us to do.
Mm.
And I remember their faces while I was performing. And it was different. I knew that it's not going to be the same since.
Hmm.
And honestly, this is what happened. We had the fight. As I said, do you remember when my Jewish, this is where we had to fight. And this is where I got it. This is where, when I understood, because when I went there, I was like, the stereotype is I'm a Palestinian guy from Lid. I'm an Arab guy from Lid. So they probably think that I'm violent, so I need to prove that I'm here as an artist. Mm. So the first thing that I did was working hard to break that stereotype. So I'm a funny guy, I'm a nice guy. At this moment, when I understood that I won't have my freedom of speech and just for saying my story, my narrative, and then they are okay to talk about Palestinians as long as they're the storytellers. That's the whole difference.
Yeah.
You know, that's the difference between a right wing and a left wing.
Yeah.
Mm. A right wing thinks you are a terrorist. A left wing doesn't think you are a terrorist, but both of them agree that they should tell the story, not me. So back then I understood that if that's the stereotype, fuck it, let it be. So this is where I went back to my Lid roots, and I was like, bring it on. Because I understood that if there's a, understood that.
Are your thoughts in background, Tamer? Sorry, Asfin.
Because I understood that if there is somebody here that deserve a stereotype, is these guys who's been talking about hip-hop as a tool to express themselves, and they've been talking about the army and Israel, and soon as a guy steps in and is like, hey, you're stepping on my land, suddenly they became... you know, they were talking about how hip hop is against the government. Suddenly, they becomes the government.
Mm.
It's like, okay, fuck it, man. I'm no more Mr. Nice Guy. And I think this is where it all,
Nick,
the passion of being a Palestinian started. the identity, some, you know, the IKEA instructions. Oh, so this is here. Started. All I needed now is to eat the right things. Mm. All I needed now is read the right book. Go again and see my friends that got killed from Arab on Arab crime, and understand that it have a straight link to what happened to 48. Watch this guy in Gaza and understand that it have a big connection to the house that they demolished here and lived. So in a way, it all made sense, and now it's time to build it.
Amazing.
And a few months after, we came out with the song Minir Habi, who's the terrorist. Right. And to be honest, I just heard it. My kids, they are like, the song is 20 years old, Minir Habi. And my kids asked about it. My kids are like 10 years old and 8 years old. And it's like, he told me like, the teacher asked me if you are the son of Tamer. And I told her yes. And she told him that she grew up on this song. And he's like, what is this song? So I played it to him. And while playing it to him, I understood the lyrics more. It was so passionate. And it was so honest that it created a big effect, a huge effect that we didn't understand back then. We didn't know how to carry it. We didn't understand that it symbolizes a whole period of Intifada.
That was the first song I heard from you, and I was a teenager, you know, and it really was a powerful, powerful message for me and resonated very strongly with me and my entire generation. You know, and it carries to this day, because you still fight the same stereotypes and smears all over the world. And it's true now as much as it was then. Listen, I wanted to talk to you about one more thing. A song you released last year around the Israeli elections, which Fashi Mashi.
Yeah.
Which is a very, I think, such an important conversation that I, as a Palestinian from Ramallah and the West Bank, don't have a full access to the conversation that happens with Palestinians in 48 about participation in elections. And I think what the cleverness of the song was offering both perspectives at the same time. And it was you internally wrestling with yourself about whether to participate or not. Why did you feel like you had to put out the song?
Because I was fighting with myself. It's like, in the big picture, I'm not comfortable voting for a parliament that doesn't have my flag.
Mm.
That doesn't have my language. That if one of the Arab Knesset members wants to talk about my pain, it has to be in Hebrew. It just doesn't. Emotionally doesn't feel right.
Mm.
Now this is what I think as in my. In my stomach, it's like. But at the same time, is it a good strategy? Is it practical? Is it the right time? These are the questions. Like, okay, let's boycott, but and what? You know what? Maybe you are right. Maybe we should boycott. But life is a process. I don't think I'm ready for that. It's questions. So I raised those questions in the. You know, the song.
I
decided to vote. At the end, I settled the argument by, I think I should.
Why did you decide to vote in the end? What was the factor that convinced you?
Do you know when we started talking about the Black Lives Matters and the way that they're protest is you know I'm already hesitating in the answer, because what I'm trying to say, something in their struggle is so enveloping the whole time, right? Something in their struggle is in a way strategically, because you have, other than the movement itself, that other than the struggle having its DNA, Martin Luther King, Malcolm X, the Black Panther, Huey, other than having that in the DNA, there's something in the hip hop community that I believe that the hip hop community really helped putting the focus on. Tell me if I'm wrong. I don't want to jump into conclusions, but I think hip hop is one of the biggest spotlights on the African American struggle. Am I right? Before I continue.
No, I think it is. It's a big form of the expression of the structures of supremacy and oppression, from NWA to everyone who's come after that.
A lot of forms shaped it, but I think that hip hop was the loudest.
Definitely, in terms of cultural significance, it has such a powerful effect in reaching millions and billions around the world.
Yes, and it's not just. I mean, it's not just, you caught me unready. This answer is, I'm not answering you. I'm sharing with you my hesitations, okay?
Please, yeah.
What I feel sometimes that we always have to be absolute here, right? Like we all, if you don't boycott, then you are a traitor. If you participate in the elections, then you are, if you don't boycott, that means you are a traitor. That's it. If you do boycott, that means you are stupid and you don't understand the struggle, the way to run the struggle. So it's always, and I allowed myself to share the question because there's a big difference between Kanye West, right, and Chuck D, Public Enemy. There's a big difference.
Yeah.
But when Katrina happened, Chuck D had something to say, and Kanye had something to say in his own way. You know, when he did that, contributing money, he was with Myers, Mike Myers, and he just looked at the camera and he's like, Bush doesn't care about black people. And the black community adopted both Chuck D and
Kanye.
It's what the black community is going to get. Like, there's this metaphor about two people is standing in front of a tree, palm tree. They are starving. They have their kids. And they are trying to get the palms, but they can't. So one of them started shaking the tree, right? And the other one just grabbed the basket. And, you know, so it's different. Malcolm X went hardcore. Martin Luther King went, I guess, more political, more peaceful. I don't know what's the right term. But the black community picked up the fruits. So I think that's very helpful when a community understands the difference of the idea. And I think we are missing that sometimes.
Yeah.
You know, it was another waking moment for me. Every time, like I said, in the club. This is strategically, because a few months before that, I had a show that the Israeli government tried to cancel again. This is something that they always do. And I had all of the Palestinian brothers and Jews surrounding me as a hero, talking, yeah, Tamer, he represents us as a national. A few months after, I did this election song, and I did a show in Ramallah, and I had like 2,000 people. I had like 5-7 Palestinians holding signs against me, calling me a traitor because of this song. So it doesn't happen, what we need to understand is there's a place for diversity between us. Diversity, is that the word?
Yeah, diverse opinions, absolutely. Yeah,
we need, you know, they say, اتفق العرب أن لا يتفقوا. The Arabs agreed not to agree.
Yeah.
We need to agree not to agree. We need to agree.
I hear you. I think so. A lot of interesting points you raise, and I agree in the fact there is the diverse opinion, etc. The argument, the way I heard it, and you also articulated in the song, is yes, as you say, in your stomach, in your chest, you don't want to legitimize a parliament that not only speaks in Hebrew, doesn't upraise your flag, but also oppresses the majority of all of your people.
24/7.
24/7. But the other thing is, okay, let's talk about strategy and pragmatism. The strategy of the last election was to remove the fascists away from the Knesset. But here they are, they still remain. The second question was, we will use our voice as a power in Israeli politics to also help our Palestinian brothers and sisters in the West Bank and Gaza. But now there's still this...
Fascism is not raising here. Fascism is raising all around the world. This is that period of time.
I'm with you.
That's the trend. If you vote or you don't vote.
Yeah. So the question is, I guess, then strategically, we haven't achieved what we wanted. في الداخل or in the West Bank and Gaza. I'm saying both. And I think... the conversation where at least I would like it to evolve is, okay, so something we're doing is not right. We're not succeeding in what we want to do. So how do we look to the future, right?
Allow us, we as people, go on, try everything, make mistakes. But sometimes we hung people that make mistakes. Allow us to make mistakes. This is, people are hesitating to make mistakes, you know. It's like the reaction of the mistake is we are so afraid to make mistakes. It won't happen without mistakes. You know, let's call the election song a mistake. I don't think it was a mistake. I'm saying. That's it. Cool. You know, allow us to jump into that water, drown, so the other one will say, okay, let's try this. But we are so afraid to fail. And falling is part of the process.
Yeah. No, I hear that. I hear that. No, for sure. And I think every lesson, and this is, you know, this goes to every Palestinian community everywhere, not just 48, that we understand where we are at the moment and how grave and dark of a time. And we learn from the lessons of those and mistakes of those who came before us. And I think it's time to start moving to something different and new that is more inclusive and is more tolerant in a way of different Palestinian perspectives and backgrounds. But at the same time, doesn't compromise on the basic values that we all want as people.
Great. Okay, thank you. So I have to take... thank you.
Yeah, just thank you so much. And amazing, amazing stuff. Thank you for joining us.
Shukran.
Yeah. Bye.
You have been listening to Palestinian rap artist Tamer Nafar speaking on Palestinian Podcast with Salem Barakhme. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You'll find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at WZBC.org. We thank you for your time. And we hope you will join us again next week for another edition of This Week in Palestine. This is your host, John Roberts, wishing you a good morning.
تمتطيه قوس قزح من مخيم إلى بلد مهجر من مخيم